everyone, and welcome to the Morris and Helen Belkin Art Gallery on this fine late summer, early fall afternoon, and to UBC Homecoming. We have a conversation here with Barbara Cole and Richard Cavell about Lionel and Patricia Thomas's mural, Symbols for Education, which was installed originally in 1958. Now, it's going to be reinstalled, and that's going to be part of the conversation, and we'll do some history on that. After the talk, we're going to invite everybody to walk down to the site with us. Just to let you know, there have been a number of departments on campus and lots of teams of people who've been working since 2021 on this. The site still isn't completed, but you'll be able to get a sneak preview. Work should be, I'm hoping things will be installed in the next few weeks before the rains happen. I'm Naomi Sawada, and I manage public programs here at the Belkin Gallery. And I'd like to acknowledge that we are on the unceded territories of the Musqueam people. The Belkin and the university is situated on these lands, and I'm going to go just a little bit further with a personal acknowledgement. I'm fourth generation Japanese Canadian, so that means four generations ago, people on my mother's side of my family, as well as my father's side of the family, would have heard something like this from officials from the province of British Columbia, and they would have said, come over here. You will have better futures for yourselves and also for your future generations. And so here I am, four generations later, speaking to you. I'm the first person in my family to come to the University of British Columbia, and I've had the pleasure of also working here for about 25 years. But I'm also going to say that we recognize that education is an ongoing practice, and it is events like this where we recognize history comes together with the present, and it will reshape the way we think about our futures. So with that, I'm going to introduce our main speakers. Barbara Cole is the founder and principal of Cole Projects. She's an artist, curator, educator, and curatorial consultant in public art, and she's the founder and producing member of Other Sites for Artists Projects. It's a nonprofit society that presents artworks that consider aesthetic, economic, and regulatory conditions of public spaces and public life. She is the former curator of outdoor art at the Belkin Gallery, and during her time here, she oversaw a number of projects, as well as the university's outdoor art collection, commissioning new things in public spaces and stewarding the existing artworks sited on the Vancouver campus, including the conservation and restoration of Lionel and Patricia Thomas's mural, Symbols of Education, and that began in 2021. It takes a while for things to happen here on campus. Cole has led a number of workshops. She's lectured and published articles on the subject of art in public space. She's taught at Emily Carr University, and she's also worked for the City of Vancouver in their public art program, and she's received the Mayor's Award for her contributions to the advancement of public art in Vancouver. Richard Campbell is professor in the Department of English and co-founder of the Bachelor of Media Studies at the University of British Columbia, and his teaching, research, and supervisions are in the field of media theory. And he works broadly in the wake of, I guess, his main mentor, one of his main mentors, Marshall McLuhan, and he's published a number of books on McLuhan, including, and I'm going to say these are all forthcoming books, like within the next 3 years. So one to be released in October of this month, so or October of this year, next month, and it is called The Explorations of Edmund Snow, Carpenter, Anthropology Upside Down, and it's about museology, cultural studies, and media studies, to be released next month. And it's from, excuse me, McGill Queen's University Press, one in 2025, excuse me, calling Mediatic Shakespeare by the University of Toronto Press, and then one in 2026 by the Communications University Press in Beijing called McLuhan in Space. I also want to acknowledge someone very special here. Mike Thomas is the son of artists Lionel and Patricia Thomas, and we thank you for coming in all the way from the Sunshine Coast to be present here for us today, and Mike will also give us some interesting back notes about his time working on murals with his parents. So with that, I will hand it over to Barbara.
Thank you, Naomi, and thanks everybody for coming. Wonderful day. How about now? Testing? Good, good, good. Okay. So I'll just jump in with this thought that invitations to speak about public art projects cause me to pause, mostly because it's an inherently complex subject and it requires really careful unpacking. There's just so many different ways I think that one can bring forward different contexts, and each one offers a different entry point into how we might engage with work. Sometimes it seems helpful to cast a really broad net and talk about the importance of public art, its history, its function, its relationality. And then other times I find that presenting a case study can sometimes be a way to talk about the work's impact that it had or it has. And that can be really useful for illustrating perhaps how layered and challenging art in public space can be. So in this particular case, I was asked to talk quite specifically about the restoration of Untitled Symbols for Education by Patricia and Lionel Thomas. And it took me a while to come up with an approach to both the research and the delivery. I found myself going through 7 years of emails, project files, budgets, and photos. And where all of that led me was right back to where the project began. And it started with a question. And that question really demanded an answer. And that was, why restore it? So a question like that, I think it suggests a process of assessment, one that really quickly centers on worth. Is the artwork worth being restored? And what's its value? And as the discussion about symbols for education evolved, it became less about the kind of worth that an art appraiser might seek to establish through comparative market values, and way more about whether the work was valued enough to warrant the time, commitment, expertise, and costs that it would take to refurbish it. So after all the research reports, discussions, and analysis, the answer was yes. So I'd really like to just touch on a few aspects of value that led us here. The value of the artist's contribution to contemporary art practice, the lasting value and relevance of the artwork itself, and the value of protecting artistic integrity. So public art reflects the conditions of its time while marking a moment within an evolving context. And Richard's going to be laying out the context of the artist milieu, the conditions of modernism, impact of technology, communication, post-World America. And so he'll be talking a little bit about their work within the fields of art, architecture, design, and pedagogy. But really, all of that will just go to show the emblematic nature of their modernist practices. And then for me, I'll be talking more about symbols. So this is really just to give you a little bit of a sense of where things were at while they were working on symbols. So a bit of a context of their own trajectory. So this was from 1956 at the Public Library, a mosaic work. And again, I'm really mostly concentrating on architecturally integrated work that they were working on. Of course, there was much, much more to talk about. The Lion in St. Mark from 1957. And this is part of UBC's public art collection, outdoor art collection. Untitled, of course, Symbols for Education, 1958. Also from 1958, also mosaic. This is in Winnipeg at the University of Manitoba, Christ the King in Glory. And then from 1960, Symbols of the Cuneiforms at the Public Library. Again, another more three-dimensional work by Lionel Thomas. And this work, Super Value Supermarket Mural from 1960, again, mosaic. And then finally, this other work that one can see around UBC. This is at the Nest, a later work from 1969 by both Patricia and Lionel. So their work, and then in relation to the company within which they kept within Vancouver, I mean, we could be opening this up to a larger format, but the top work is Tactanabe in Winnipeg, the Builders Exchange Mosaic from 1956. Below it, another mosaic, Robert Bruce from 1957, also in Winnipeg. Of course, the BC Binning, the BC Electric building from 57, so just before Symbols. And then from 58, the same year, Symbols for Education, again, a BC Binning. This one is, you can still see this, it's at Shoppers Drug Mart. It was the Imperial Bank of Commerce. And not unlike Symbols for Education, this was also offered up a guide for how one might read the symbols included within the mural, again, BC Binning. And then finally, this one of two mosaic murals by Gordon Smith, and this was at, and you can still see it at SFU. So I just want to mention art historian David Bellman. He was quoted as saying that Lionel and Patricia helped create a new environment. And in fact, their impact was not limited to the historical Vancouver cityscape. And Bellman and his partner, they were part of Causa Collective and did an exhibition at the Belkin Satellite when it was operative here in Vancouver back in 2015. And I really like this quote that appears on the Belkin's website that kind of summarizes, I think, the value of the contributions of the Thomases at that time and really kind of acknowledges their respective practices in a really great way. So Symbols is one of 24 artworks in the outdoor art collection. Of course, the Belkin has a much, much larger collection of over 5,000 works within their fonds here. but the outdoor art collection is relatively small. And when we look at these, I mean, ranging, the first piece was installed in 1925, the last piece last year. And if we looked at that trajectory over each decade, really it comes together as kind of a tracing of societal values and also the understanding of the role of public art, and especially within the unique setting of UBC. This image just shows some of the artworks that were either commissioned, installed, or refurbished in the last 10 to 15 years. So here's the diagrammatic, the individual panels that contribute to the holistic reading of Untitled, Symbols for Education, that can be conceived as a type of a map. Well, it is a diagram in this case. But really, even as the piece operated, I think, within the grounds, it was really a diagram or a table of contents of education at the time, and was a bit of a roadmap for what we might expect to be to carry us into the future. And really, the panels, they carried a very idiosyncratic lexicon of symbols that for them represented the different disciplines. But those symbols came from very different sources, as this, you probably can't read this, but if one was to look through this guide, you can see where from the various sources that they drew from for creating those symbols. And in their respective practices, both Patricia and Lionel, they really encouraged this interrelationship between the arts. And they worked very hard to maintain relationships between the visual arts, architecture, and landscape. And you can see in this piece that the work extended not only from on the wall, but there was consideration about the plaza in front, the reflecting pool. All of that was this part of this interconnected whole. So when the Belkin first heard that the Brock Hall was going to be decommissioned to make way for the very new and expansive Brock Commons, the first round of questions that was brought forward to the University Art Committee really centered around the artwork's place within the larger outdoor art collection. What did it represent in relation to its history? But then these other questions also became really paramount, and that was it inextricably tied to its site? Was it possible for it to be removed from that particular context and location? And could it retain its relevance? And so we did explore the possible relocations for the artwork. This is just one example of some of the permutations that it went through or possibly could go through. And this was all on paper, so just trying different things out as we walked around the campus and looked for potential integrated situations for the work. We'd really identified what it was that we thought were important aspects of the work's legacy, so those contextual connections, really good sight lines, while also maintaining a really direct physical relationship to the viewer, so like in really close proximity to be able to just almost reach out and touch, as well as this idea of integration into architectural space. And so, I mean, there was many, many, many people involved in this kind of planning that extended beyond the Balkan into the campus and community planning, building services, all kinds of other folks became very much involved. And it became clear that what we were aiming towards and what we settled upon was to actually build a purpose-built exterior wall for the artwork that would be in relation to where it used to be, in proximity, very close proximity to the Brock Commons building itself. One passes by it to enter into some of the entryways. It would just kind of have this really special connection that we thought was worth maintaining. I'll segue now into the conservation process, but I didn't want to leave behind this idea of value. I want to say that the importance was placed on being as true to the original artwork as possible. So we didn't want to do a facsimile, but rather we wanted to restore as much of the artist's original intent as possible. And certainly the conservators that we worked with, Fraser Spafford, Ricky, they were adamant that be maintained, the original artwork's appearance and originality. And what they were quoted as saying was that the artist's intent should be the strongest voice. So a big shout out to Fraser Spafford Ricky, but also a project like this, it really requires a lot of champions. And Catherine Elkenbrack, who worked with campus and community planning at that time and was a longtime University Art Committee member, was really big at pushing this project through. And then we all benefited, in effect, from the support she was able to garner from the provost at that time. And then, of course, the full support, ongoing support, unwavering support and skill from the full Balkan team, especially Owen Sapotichuk, who did above and beyond, and then also the support and guidance from the University Art Committee and the Outdoor Arts Subcommittee. So in terms of the conservation itself, the Balkans files included very brief explanation about the history of the work, but very little documentation of the original materials, the structure, or the methods of the wall attachments. And the conservators, they learned quite a bit about how the mosaic was made and installed from how they took it apart. And Daniel's here from Spafford Ricky, so we can maybe call on him for any details that I'm sure to miss. But So as you saw, the work's made up of 54 panels, rectangular panels of glass tiles, and they were held in place on mortar in a bed of cement, strengthened by iron mesh, and then backed with a grid of iron bars. So this weighed more than it, like it, we can say it weighed a ton, but it actually weighed more than that. So they were, the panels were surrounded by these bronze channels or frames, And the bronze, it extended beyond the individual to connect these various parts. So as I say, that interrelationality between them of how these different disciplines were kind of connected together was really important, both physically and metaphorically. And so the mosaic panels were held in place with mounting rods that were embedded deeply into the brick. The tiles were laid in what's referred to as an indirect method, where the image is actually constructed upside down, face down, and something that Mike can talk about his experience as a child of actually putting this together, helping his parents. Anyway, the whole process of this was very evolving, especially for the conservators as they gathered more information as they went along and then responded to what they were learning. So they began actually by taking off these particular three panels, taking them back to the lab and really doing an analysis on them. And from that, I mean, they knew to what degree the restoration, what would be entailed with that. The tiles actually were in pretty good shape themselves. Some were cracked that needed replacement, but otherwise it was really the crumbling of the mortar and the cement and the corrosion of the iron that caused the most concern and that they had to really kind of deal with in their proposal for how the work would be restored. This is just an example of the many different avenues that were and the things that were considered that went into that restoration. This in itself is just a calculation of weight and the weight distribution on the wall. The piece on the left, the drawing on the left, showed the original configurations of those clusters of panels. And then the piece on the right proposes how those panels would be cut off to come down with minimal disruption, and then how they might be then reinstalled when the time came after the restoration process. So a further distribution of the weight in the most, I'm going to go back because there is a moment here. COVID. So that was a didn't know that was coming moment, and I think that it had its repercussions, ripple effect everywhere. Where the conservators had figured out a method for protecting the work and bringing the work down, as I say, with minimal disruption, they weren't able to actually exercise that at the beginning of COVID with all of the restrictions on how construction was required to unfold, distance between, all of that. And so construction was still barreling ahead here at UBC, as construction was throughout BC. But their work could not. And so they figured out a very detailed instruction for the construction crews to actually take down the work for them. And then once it was in their studio, they could then do the work. But regardless of how many people are at the table, how well the communications are, there's always something that's going to happen. And it happened. And one very ambitious construction worker knew the work had to come down solo, went in there with his sawzall, and he took it down. So cut through the bronze channeling, removed the work without any protection of the tiles. And by the time we were called, Sarah and Tara and myself were on our hands and knees going through the ground, picking up mosaic tile that had pinged off in the process, and then seeing the panels laid out inside Brock Hall. It was a very sad moment for sure, and it marked a very important moment in the evolution of the consultation and all of that with all the various departments of what to do next. So it required a whole new conservation plan to deal with the amount of damage that had happened from the way it was taken down, and then also how the works would become interconnected again eventually. So that was a major event within the trajectory of this work. Fast forward, so this is the studios, the studio that was rented specifically for this work by the conservators. There's Daniel cutting off one of the bronze frames. A couple of before and afters of the cleaning process, so all of the organic material growing in the mortar. Another before and after, and then a new mortar backing that the tiles could then be embedded within. I'm skimming, and Daniel can really help us here after this. But the tiles that we could that were used for color matching, cutting tiles for missing pieces, so cutting them to shape and reinstalling, of course, onwards with the cleaning, laying out, and then the bronze channeling and figuring out how everything would then come together. And then in the meantime, the wall itself, so different departments again, the landscape company, campus and community planning, properties trust, project services, all coming together to design this purpose-built wall. And then Owen again back to the drawing board of just double checking, triple checking, quadruple checking the measurements, dimensions of the wall in relation to the kind of space that the piece needed to actually breathe, as well as have that relationship to the viewer. Owen checking on the wall surface, because that's what he does. And then installing this really brilliant installation of the mechanism for putting the work up. So the work is probably going to be around for a lot longer than the 60 years that the first version was, in that there's a non-corrosive materials being used, stainless steel backing. This cleat system allowed for the frames to come in independent, so that all of the joints and spaces between were as tight as possible. So everything was kind of put, measured, installed, and then those frames were taken down, taken back to the lab, and the tile, the mosaic panels inserted, and then they'll come back and just be installed in one fell swoop. So that was kind of the whirlwind there. And this is just, just an example of the many, many people involved. And this was just from me taking down names from going through all of my emails. So I'm missing lots and lots of other people. But just to give you a sense of really what's involved in that kind of process. So I'm going to turn it over to Richard, and then Richard in turn will turn it over to Mike for a few words, and then we can open it up. So thanks.
I'm going to give you a bit of the context.
The 1950s context here is very interesting. It is one in which there was an increasing internationalism being felt at UBC, and that internationalism had something to do with the frequent appearance on this campus of someone who became internationally known as the founder of media studies. And that is Marshall McLuhan. I've called this Symbols for Education, Symbols for Revolution, because the mural was very, very far looking. It was not really a reflection of what was happening here at UBC. It was an idealistic representation of education. For instance, we have one mosaic that refers to the Faculty of Dentistry, but there was no Faculty of Dentistry in 1958. It was founded in 64, and in fact, they're celebrating their 60th anniversary this year. So there's very much an idealized university that's being depicted here, and the implications of that idealized university are particularly evident in the fact that this is a double mosaic, really. We have a series of 54 mosaics, but their articulation on the wall is also a mosaic. And this immediately ran counter to the way that education was experienced on the UBC campus in the 50s and the 60s. I enrolled here as a student in 1967. The tuition then was $400, which tells you how long ago it was. I think it's now $15,000 if you're a Vancouverite and about $35,000 if you're not. It was in some ways a very small university, a very idealized university that at a time when there was a great deal of ferment on university campuses internationally. The rigid classifications of learning that were evident at universities such as UBC were beginning to be stretched a little too far, and students wanted another way of understanding the knowledge that universities produced. They wanted, in fact, and Barbara already alluded to this, far greater degree of interaction, interactivity, or what came to be called interdisciplinarity. I've also taught in this building. You'll see some of the rust in this particular image. One year that I taught, we had to teach in a circle because there was a huge puddle in the middle of the room and the ceiling was leaking while I taught, which is one reason why it only took University of British Columbia 22 years to then tear it down. It was a very interesting place to teach, not the best place to teach, but the most wonderful thing was coming from my office and walking by this wonderful mural. Here you see the schematic of it. And there's some very interesting aspects to, in fact, the mural. For instance, at the very top, you can see at the very top, they have music. And to the right of music, they have, in fact, the golden section or the Fibonacci sequence. Okay, this is very, very interesting. Here at the top, because the Fibonacci sequence is in both nature and in culture, okay? So the Fibonacci sequence is what makes the seashell round in spirals. It's a sequence that is very easy to do. 0 plus 1 is 1, 2 plus 1 is 3, plus 2 is 5, plus 3 is 8, increasingly. But it's interesting that it also produces the golden section or the golden ratio, which is the classical size of an octavo book. So in other words, the mural encapsulates both culture and nature in a way that was quite radical for the time. To the extreme left, you find forestry, but it's also represented in terms of a maze. On the extreme right, three tiles down, you see the beautiful long blue one representing architecture. That's actually the floor plan of the Parthenon. So we have a highly, highly idealistic representation of what learning might become on the UBC campus. It hadn't, I can tell you that as a student here, it hadn't quite achieved that then. Now, part of the context, as I said at the outset, was McLuhan's relationship to UBC. He was often out here, and in fact, he did something for the fine arts department over the period 1961 to 1971, which was a series of summer events organized around the idea of media. They became world famous. Artists of international repute were here, from Robert Rauschenberg to John Cage to Smithson, all coming to participate in this McLuhan event. McLuhan was fascinated by the idea of the mosaic as an alternate way of understanding knowledge systems. And in 1958, he gave a very famous talk in the old library, which is still there. It's the stone part that is the very first slide that Barbara showed us. McLuhan went through that door in the summer of 1958 to give a lecture to the National Association of Radio Broadcasters, who had invited McLuhan to give a talk and assure radio broadcasters that television would not destroy radio. And you can see Marshall writes here, you know, I gave this talk in 1958 in Vancouver to assure radio broadcasters that radio was not going to disappear as a result of television. But of course, he wasn't quite telling them the truth. What he told them was that radio would be remediated by television. That is, radio would now become the content of television. So if I wanted to hear the news, I would in fact turn on the news on my television. That made them happy at the time because they didn't understand what he was talking about. Most people didn't understand what Marshall was talking about. He often himself didn't understand what he was talking about, but it turned out to be prophetic. This is someone who talked about the internet before the PC was invented. So he was quite a prophetic individual. Now, this central idea of the mosaic is embodied in this wonderful work that we've been looking at. And the idea of the medium and the message, as McLuhan put it in that famous 1958 talk, merging such that the medium is the message, as he put it then, gained international attention. And I'm stressing this at UBC because I think there should be a little plaque up at the old library pointing out what the greatest living French philosopher of the 1980s pointed out, that the merging of the medium and the message, McLuhan, is the first great formula of the New Age, and that New Age was the postmodernist age, the age which moved away from a consideration of content to a consideration of what in artistic terms we could call form or the medium. And of course, it's the form of the mosaic that is absolutely fascinating, this brilliant series of juxtapositions to also create a work of art. So it's both intellectual, but it's also something beautiful to look at. In his first major book, The Gutenberg Galaxy, McLuhan wrote about the mosaic as the new way that one needs to organize knowledge in an information culture. The Gutenberg Galaxy develops a mosaic or field approach to its problems. Such a mosaic image of numerous data and quotations in evidence offers the only practical means of revealing causal operations in history. And this was the buzz of the world, but especially of the UBC campus. There was a highly, highly organized intellectual community in Vancouver in the 50s and the 60s. The major figures in this group of intellectuals were the Freedmans, both medical doctors, both founders of the medical faculty at UBC, who had a beautiful house. It's still there in the Little Australia part of our campus. It's recently been restored. It was under threat of being demolished, which is when I published this book, and it helped to save it. So the house is still there. And weekly, the Freedmans would invite people over like B.C. Binning and many, many other artists to discuss art. And this created a milieu in Vancouver that made it into a city that was really very much in the avant-garde. I mean, I can remember when Igor Stravinsky came to Vancouver because school children, I went to school here as well, were invited to attend a rehearsal by Erwin Hoffman and the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra with Stravinsky conducting. Okay. So that was happening in the 50s and the 60s. It was very, very avant-garde. And I see this mural as being part of that avant-garde. Now, as I said a moment ago, this was a period of great stress within educational systems, and radical movements began to arise. This is someone called Jerry Rubin. Jerry Rubin was the chief agitator in what were then called the Yippies. Not the Yuppies, but the Yippies. I was a second-year student in 1968, and Rubin came to campus in the spring of that year and gathered a huge number of students outside the student union building. And after getting us worked up, he said, "What's the one place on campus that you guys can't go into?" And someone shouted out, "The faculty club." So there was a huge, huge mob of people going over to the faculty club. You can see there used to be a picture right on the club, but there's a website that UBC devotes to the quote-unquote invasion of the faculty club. And we all followed Ruben over. I myself didn't go in. I decided I would wait to become a professor and go in legitimately, which I subsequently did. But this was part of an international upsurge in Europe and elsewhere, student agitation for change in the educational system. And I'm arguing to you that I think there are elements of that change represented by the mosaic. And there we all are, except for me, in the faculty club in 1968, having liberated it from the old form of teaching and hoping that a new form of teaching would arise that some of us, including myself, see to be inherent in this wonderful symbols for education. Thank you very much.
So, Mike, maybe talking more about mosaics from yet another pretty hands-on point of view, I'd say.
So, long talks like these guys, based upon a lot of research, at the time that my sister and I laid most of that mosaic and for the Vancouver Public Library, by slave labor. Now, I don't want to report my parents for labor violations, and it's a little late to punish them for it. But I was about 10 at the time, so there's also the child labor component. My sister was 14. She's sadly passed away now, but regardless, so I'm the only one who gets blamed for any of this. So I only got a 4-minute talk, and all 4-minute talks should have a title. So I've called this Dust. Why, you might ask? Well, my father hired a mason, an Italian, of course, the name Gino. And Gino had a relative who lived in Genoa. So Gino did rock work all around our house, which was situated on Capilano Road in North Van. And then all of a sudden, the drawings were all over the floor, everywhere. The living room, the basement, everywhere. And they were all the individual components of the Brock Hall mural. And then the freighter showed up, and along came trucks of this mosaic tile. And now all of a sudden, we got all this mosaic tile. And the appropriate bags are placed, and my sister and I had to pick through them and identify this and that. And every time you touched the burlap sacks, a little puff of dust came out. And that's the nature of the name of the story. So all Saturday after school, you've been good. Go and lay tile for a couple of hours. You've been bad. Go and lay tile for a couple of hours. It went on and on and on. It was a huge project because we were also involved. My parents were in the mosaic age at that time. So there was the Middlegate Mall. There was the Vancouver Public Library inside mall, mural, and so on and so forth. So there was lots of work for the kids for not much money. So anyway, we did this, but every time you went into these burlap sacks, you got the cloud of dust coming out of it. So I thought it was just appropriate to paint the picture of the kids slaving away in the basement or wherever they've been assigned to lay this tile. And my younger brother hadn't been born yet, so we couldn't put him to work. So we were it, and we did most of that tile laying. And then my father would come along and glue brown paper onto the top so that they could be transferred into a mortar box and so on and so forth. So I hesitate to take credit away from my parents, but my sister and I did a lot of work on this thing. And that's all I got to say. I think probably used up 4.5 minutes. I wasn't timing.
Thank you so much, Mike, and Barbara, and Richard. Does anybody have any questions or comments? We have about a few minutes.
Good afternoon. Perhaps a simple question on technique. Look at Mike. There was a reference to an indirect technique or something. Does that mean it's done like in reverse, face down somehow, and then you just?
I wasn't sure. I was thinking about that the other day because that was probably a question that was come up and you brought it up right away. Because it's possible if you can raise the tile and get it into the mortar, but that's a pretty tough order. So I think that they were actually reversed and then they were transferred. And I wasn't privy to the transferring. That was, in fact, most of that work was done at UBC, close to Brock Hall. So I can't really honestly answer your question, but it's possible it was all done in reverse, yep.
Anyone else?
Is there a completion date assigned to the project?
Completion date.
Daniel and I were talking just before the talk, and Daniel, you were thinking probably 2 weeks, three weeks?
Yeah, I hope before the first week of October.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Just wondering that the mural and then the map that you have, is there possible to, is that available to?
Is it on our website already, the Balkans website?
I don't know, but we will certainly get one to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyone else? So we have a few moments. We'd like to invite all of you to take a walk to the new site if you're interested. Just to let you know, Barbara has mentioned there are, you know, teams of people have been working on this for the past,
well, since 2017, actually. Yeah.
So there's still, you know, construction. It's still a site, but you're welcome. We're going to walk over there and take a sneak peek before the actual installation hopefully begins in a week or two, yes. Mm-hmm. So thank you everybody for coming, and let's walk over.